Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 6 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I am your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm really excited to be bringing you this new season of shows coming to you on the first and third Wednesdays of every month. I have a great lineup of fascinating conversations with incredible musicians, songwriters, guitarists, steel guitarists, drummers, composers, who knows what else. I've been having an incredible time diving deep with these folks, and I know you're going to enjoy listening. Just a reminder that this year I've taken out the short song samples through the show, as things have gotten way more complicated as far as legal use of music goes, so I'll be making an accompanying Spotify playlist to each episode, which you'll find in the episode's show notes and at the website at makersandshakerspodcast.com. So anytime you hear this cute little slide guitar sound, you'll know there's a track to go along with it on the playlist. We have some new sponsors this year, but continue to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription. Patreon is a monthly payment of your choice, and when you sign up for that, you get a bit of added content as well as an ad-free version of the show to listen to. If you don't feel like kicking in any dough, that's cool too, but you can help by subscribing for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just spread the word by sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff, of course, at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, many thanks to our sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know that I sent you. They are Isotope, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, and Spectra 1964. Hey there, music nerds and folks from around the world. Welcome back to Season 6 of the show. This is episode number 121. I'm really excited to bring you this conversation with the incredible singer, songwriter, and someone who's had a number of really interesting collaborations throughout her career, Aoife O'Donovan. She has a brand new album out that she recorded remotely during the pandemic, produced by Joe Henry, and the album is called Age of Apathy. And it's a really incredible piece of work. The singing, songs, imagery, layers of interesting guitar parts and other instruments all make what she does totally unique. And I wanted to talk to her about how she worked on the new music. And as it turns out, we had some similar COVID recording experiences, which I wanted to talk about too. One of which was working remotely with the mighty drummer and percussionist Jay Bellerose. And Jay was set up in his living room through the pandemic, and his wife Jen Kondos was recording him quite often. And Jay did a bunch of work for me that way, and as it turns out, also played on Aoife's record that way as well. And, you know, the process of writing and recording for people is already really interesting, but to throw in everyone's crazy COVID experiences and how that affected their lives and process during the last couple of years is just as wild. And it seems like Aoife hit a creative stride after a mid-pandemic move, which I can also relate to. But she moved to Florida in Orlando, I believe, and the new album is the result of this creative spurt that she had. I first came to know of Aoife through her work with the band that she was in called Crooked Still, and I believe she was the founding member of that band as well. And maybe about 15 years ago, we were put together on a workshop stage at the Vancouver Folk Fest, and her voice and writing really struck me back then. And Crooked Still made a bunch of cool albums over the years, but she broke out and started releasing her own solo records in 2013. And she worked with Tucker Martine on some of those early solo records, and he's been on the show, and I wanted to talk to her a bit about that, because he's an interesting dude that makes cool records, and so we get into that here. And she's done a bunch of really cool side projects. Some of them include the trio that she's in called I'm With Her. That's with her and Sarah Giroux and Sarah Watkins. Both of those people have also been on this show. If you haven't heard their episodes, go check them out. And she's collaborated with Chris Thiele, Yo-Yo Ma, Jerry Douglas, and lots more great people. And I also had the honor to be asked to record Alison Russell's vocals for Aoife's new album. She wanted Allie to sing on some songs, and she came over and did that at my place. So I got a sneak peek of the material from the record back then when we did those tracks. And when Aoife and I spoke for this episode, the record had not yet come out, so I hadn't heard the entire thing, just the songs that I'd worked on and a couple more. But it's out now, and I highly encourage you to go and have a listen and go get yourself a copy. It's called Age of Apathy. You can stream it or buy a vinyl copy, and you can also get info on all of Aoife's extensive touring activities. She's really back at it in a big way at aoifeodonovan.com, and that's AOIFEODONOVAN.com. How's that? Also, just wanted to put a shout out to Stephen Kaplan and thank him for making a donation to the show this week. It's much appreciated, as always. All right, let's get down to it. Enjoy my conversation with Aoife O'Donovan. Well, thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for your involvement.
I've had both Sarahs on this show as well, so you're I'm with her trifecta now.
Oh, awesome. I love it.
And I don't know if you know the connection here as well, but I recorded Allie.
I know. That's what I mean by thanks by your involvement. Yeah. So
Okay.
You were like directly involved in three songs on the record.
I was.
Really cool.
I was. Yeah. And I got a little sneak peek a few months ago. So that was cool.
Oh, awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing that. And those parts are so critical to the sound of the record. So I really appreciate it. And it's cool to come full circle. And you said, and we met in Canada like years ago, right?
So I remember you playing with Crooked Still at the Vancouver Folk Fest, and we got stuck on one of those workshops together. And I was playing with a band called Zubat and Dawson. We had a duo that was like, I was playing Weisenborn and the other guy was playing fiddle. And we did a workshop, you know, one of those things that they stick you on.
I love those. I can't wait. Next time I'm at a Canadian folk festival, I'm just going to be like, I'll do any workshop forever for the whole weekend. It's like the things that you don't realize that you miss so much is like,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. Yeah, for me, like I'm from Vancouver and I hadn't been back in 2 years or so. I hadn't even been to Canada in almost 2 years. So it was a little weird for me. And then I went back to make a record about 6 months ago, and it seemed like things were getting back to normal then, and now everything's off the rails again. So I don't know what the hell's going on. Do you have any bookings for Canadian festivals this summer? Or
not yet. I have a lot of bookings for American and European stuff, but I'm going to, okay, when we hang up, and this is going to like, I'm going to call my manager and be like, get me on a Canadian festival. I love Canadian festivals so much. I mean, I really do. And Crooked Still had such a great run at all the Canadian festivals. And I'm with her, did a bunch of them too. And when I was pregnant 5 years ago, I guess now, 5 summers ago, I did Winnipeg and Vancouver. And I remember just like being there pregnant. Like, it's just a funny memory, yeah, I have of doing those festivals solo with like a big belly.
Right, right. Is there some connection with you to Vancouver? Like, I don't know if it's if it was just sort of a random pick, but that song Stanley Park on
yeah, I mean, I love Vancouver. That was just random. It wasn't based on, I mean, it was based on me running a really long run in Vancouver on a really cold morning after I played St. James
on the seawall.
The whole it was like a 10 or 11 mile run, and it was one of those just,
yeah, that's
like
a good haul.
Yeah, it was so, I was staying at like the Marriott downtown or something. And I remember I did this really long run and kind of wrote that song and then walked from the hotel to Meat and Bread, this place that has these great sandwiches in like the Gaslight District, I think it's called, or
Gastown.
Gastown, yeah. So I love Vancouver. I've had great, such great, I have so many great like food memories from Vancouver. There's this great place, East West. Do you know that place, East West?
No.
It's like, it's
Where's
near,
that?
There's actually a couple of locations, but it's near, one of them, the first place I had it was near St. James Hall. Do you know that place I'm talking about? That like,
for sure, yeah. I've played there probably 50 times.
I love that place so much. And you get these naan burritos. They're like, it's like,
oh, I do know that place. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think about that meal, like that non burrito is I put really? That up there. I mean, I really do. And they like, there's a bigger restaurant there. I go there every time I'm in Vancouver. Like now you really know me. This is what I care about, is finding the best sandwich of all sorts wherever I am.
Eastwood. Yeah, I forgot about that place. But now that you mention it, they get music in there sometimes. And there's a classical Indian lap steel guitar player in Vancouver that had sort of a house gig there. And I sat in with them a few times there.
So that's my dream. My dream house gig. I'm moving to Vancouver so I can be my new life.
You'll just do it for the burritos.
I will.
So where do you live now? Are you in Boston?
No, I haven't lived in Boston in 13 years. Or I grew up there. I live in Florida right now, but I grew up in Boston.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I lived in New York for many years, and I still have, you know, strong ties to New York. And I came down here. My husband has a job here. He's the conductor of the orchestra in Orlando. And we were in New York for the first part of the pandemic. And then because he was able to do a season, an outdoor distanced mask season with all this open space and beautiful weather, we came down here and we kind of moved here full time last September. And we're staying put here for the time being, and probably end up back in the Northeast eventually. But it's been a really, really nice place to land during all this, because it's progressive. Yeah. It's like a really nice progressive pocket of a crazy state, but it's like so much gorgeous nature. And it's like the hidden secret of the South. I love it here so much. It's great.
Are you actually in Orlando?
I'm in Orlando. I'm in a 100-year-old house on a brick-lined street, like right in the old part of the town. It's great.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk about the new record, Age of Apathy. I love it. I don't know it well yet because I've only heard, I recorded some of the Ali Russell's vocals for it. So I heard those songs, and then I've heard some of the other stuff. And I actually got my hands on the whole record this morning. So, but I'd love to talk about the process and where you were when you did it. I know Joe Henry, and we talked when I was going to work on the record, and I know a little bit that you were doing it remotely. But could you tell me about like how remotely it was? Were you totally doing your own stuff and Joe was sort of like involved from afar? And I actually recorded some of my own music and had Jay Bellerose play on it, and Jen Condos recorded him in their house. So I think we've been through some similar things lately with that whole thing. And I would love to find out how that process was for you.
Yeah, it was a really bizarre process. I've never worked in this way before. I was here in Florida when I started the record, and there's this great school here called Full Sail University in Winter Park, which is right where I am. I'm, you know, 2 miles from Winter Park. And I became, you know, I got in touch with people who run that place through my husband. Actually, there's a composer who's a faculty member there, Keith Lay, and he introduced me to Darren Schneider, who's one of the head engineers at the school.
It's like an audio recording school, right?
It's an audio recording school. It's a huge, they have tons of students. It's an incredible facility. They do audio recording, they do gaming, they do engineering, production. It's kind of like a mecca for young engineers to come and sort of cut their teeth and figure out how to record. And a lot of people go on to do huge things. So a lot of the engineers who come through there, but all this to say, there was this basically an empty studio that you know, because students were largely not on campus. A lot of stuff was remote last year. And I kind of got hooked up with them and was able to record there with this incredible engineer, you know, pretty much like all the time. I was going, you know, 3, 4, 5 days a week. I would go and then leave the studio and eat my lunch on the way to pick up my daughter from school. It was this really cool, because there was no, like, you know, there was no hanging out. It wasn't like we were hanging out in the control room.
Right.
I was in the booth and Darren was in the control room, and, you know, we weren't in the same room. This is like pre-vaccine. We were just recording and staying separate. And I was like, it's just these funny things of when you make a record. So much of making a record for me, for all of us musicians, is just about hanging out. Like the hang is such a huge part of being a musician.
Totally.
And there, it was funny to sort of not have any of that for this record. It was just like, work, go, go, go. And, and Joe got involved pretty early on in the process. I had called him. We had been in touch, and we're friends. We've worked together before on shows, never in a recording context. But I'd always wanted to make a record with him. I really connect with him. He's such a beautiful soul, a beautiful spirit. And he, I called him. I said, do you want to do this record together? And you know, this is where I'm at with it. I've got these songs I'm working on and I have the studio, but it's all going to have to be remote because there's not really any way to kind of gather in a way that makes sense. It just felt like it was too stressful to try to, I don't know, do something like that. I have a child. I live in Florida. Like nobody's near here. So he signed on and the songs just kind of started to roll out. Like I was making these demos myself in Florida. I was recording acoustic guitar, electric guitar, piano, Rhodes, vocals, et cetera. And I would send them to Joe. And initially I thought these were just demos and we were going to kind of start from scratch and start over. But what ended up happening is a lot of those early, you know, basic tracks of my guitars and keys ended up really being the bedrock of what was to come next.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
Yeah. So, I recut a lot of the vocals, but not even all of them. And then we would sort of send the tracks, you know, in small groups to Jay Bellarose, whose wife Jen would record him in their house and he would send them back and we would fold them in and Joe would get them first. And then Darren would get them and I would show up at the studio and there'd be the song with drums. And I'd be like, whoa, there's drums.
It's kind of cool, right?
It was crazy. But the really crazy thing is that, you know, I've been a band leader. I've been a band member. I've been a side person. I've sort of had been in every context of the room and the recording session, but I've never before experienced writing a song and then having somebody play on it that you have not personally communicated with about how you want it to sound.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, usually you're like, all right, try this, or I'm hearing like the drums coming in on this part, or how about a big fill there, or don't play this bass note because like, that's not what I'm hearing in my ears. There was none of that, which at first was really jarring. Like I would get these things back and I'd be like, whoa, that's totally not what I thought they were going to do on that song.
Especially with Jay playing, who's the most unpredictable drummer of all time.
But it really was every single person who was on the record. It was just this like surprise.
Yeah.
And it was such an exercise for me in patience and actually sitting with something, because I'm such an immediate, like, I don't like that, don't do that, I don't know, do this, da, da, da. And it was really cool to then have this finished product be all these things that I'm pretty sure had I been in the room when they were happening, I would have been like, don't do that, do something different, I don't like that, that's not the part that I want there. And I'm so just like delighted with how it turned out.
So for me in that process, I found that the negatives were the obvious things, like what you say, where you're not there and you don't really have that immediate interplay with all those people that shapes how things sound. But I found that there were positives to the experience that I wasn't expecting. And without really communicating to you what those are, were there surprising things that for you were positives of that experience?
Oh, everything was positive. I don't even think there was really a negative. It felt more collaborative in a way. I think I went into it thinking it would be less collaborative or mm-hmm. less that people would have less invested in the project who were playing on it, but it ended up feeling like a real something that we were making together.
Right.
And I think that's been especially true as I've gone on and played some of these. I've played a couple of live shows of the music and hearing David Pilch's bass parts, you know, with Ethan Yojevitz playing them but they're like Pilch parts and they're on right. my song that he contributed. Now they're this sort of like this essential part of the song without me having even known that they were so essential.
Right.
I think that's a really cool thing. And Ali's vocals on like on Prodigal Daughter and on Elevators, like just these really cool things that were different than how I was sort of imagining them be just to sound in my head. Then she sings them and then that becomes the jumping off point for whoever's going to do it live or you know, it's right. just, it's a really, it just feels like everybody now
cool.
has their own stamp on it. And it's just, I love it.
So were you communicating at all with Jay and David and
I mean Joe was. I wasn't personally. Like I think I really left that in Joe's hands. And I think he was okay. communicating, but you know, letting them really they were kind of going back and forth. And sometimes he would send me like a sketch and I'd be like, yeah, that's cool. But this the first thing that Pilch played on was like the Town of Mercy. a song that Joe and I wrote together. And he sent back this, you know, this idea of this, like this opening, his bass entrance. And I was like, oh, like, I'm just really not sure about that. And I kind of sat with it and I was like, yeah, I'm really not sure about that. I think I would like to hear a couple other options, and I'm pretty sure I'll go with another option. And then I, you know, sent back some more options and I was like, yeah, how about this way? And then it turned out that once I had heard that thing, that first way he did it, his first instinct, after like a week or something, I was like, it just has to be that. I have to go back to that, because now it's in there and it's like, I can't get it out.
How was the writing process for you? I don't know at what point you started writing all this material, but was it like post-pandemic? Had you ever had a chance to play any of these songs live before you recorded them, or was it all just sort of born out of that?
No, okay. God, no. It was all born out of this time. I had started writing, I think the earliest scraps for this record probably started in January of 2020 before the pandemic, because I was sort of getting into the mindset of trying to write for a new record. But really, like the earliest scraps, I think like the verse of What Do You Want From Yourself, I think is like the only thing that came from before the pandemic.
Okay.
And Prodigal Daughter actually had kind of been kicking around, like, so I started writing it with Tim O'Brien like almost a decade ago.
Oh, really?
But the rest of the material, in addition to a couple other songs that I recorded that didn't make it on the record that I released over the summer, were all pandemic. I wrote them all during the pandemic. And mostly, you know, in the post summer 2020 pandemic, like starting in September, started writing some stuff when I was still in New York, but most of the stuff kind of was finished when I got down to Florida and kind of had space and, you know, a room to write in. This is like my sunroom, and I have lots of light. It's so bright that I have to have the blinds drawn right now, but it's like, I had this really nice space to be, and my daughter was in school, and I had kind of really kind of rediscovered my creative, you know, juice, I guess, which was definitely, not there the first part of the pandemic.
That's sort of a short period of time. Like, you must have been very productive for those couple months.
It was wildly productive time. I wrote more music in that time period than like I will ever write again. Like, I don't really know where it came from, but it came out.
And so you were writing, and then at what point did you get involved with Joe? Like, at what point did you feel like you had the material at least underway to start forming it into a record?
It all kind of happened pretty quickly. I probably had like three or four, or maybe like half the material before I called Joe. And then starting in I think I called Joe in December, like right before Christmas or right around the holidays. And I got back to Florida January 1st. And then I just like couldn't stop. I was just writing. And I would write something and I'd be like up in this room at night. And then I would wake up in the morning and I'd go to the studio and cut it. And then I would listen to it. And then I'd like add another verse or take a verse. Just because I had the studio sort of like almost as a workspace as well.
Yeah.
It enabled me to be more productive, I think, than I would have been had I just been at home.
Right. Right.
And I was sending Joe demos, sending him lyrics, like he was writing back, recording, sending stuff. Like, so by the time we had, I think we finished that like round of, I think we had like 13 or 14 songs really pretty quickly, like by mid-February. Amazing. Or the end of February. And then we started sending stuff out, and then it kind of took another 2 months to get it all back.
So he's a very much like a live, everyone in the same room kind of guy. That's how he's always worked. I don't know if he did any other records in this way during the pandemic, aside from his own.
His own.
So was he hesitant about doing it this way at all? Or was he in?
Not at all. He had just done his own record this way. So okay. I think he really jumped in. And it was so exciting at the end of this process when we were able to be together and mix or master the record together. We mixed all on Zoom. Are you drinking a beer?
No, it's a sparkling water.
Oh, okay. I've never seen that can, but I guess it's from Trader Joe's. I see now. I was like, it's like, geez. All right, buddy. It was really great when we finally got to be in the same room and actually like sit next to each other and master the record and go out to dinner. Like those things that, I don't know, like I said, the hang is such a big part of music making.
Yeah. Usually, are you really involved in the mix and master process? Is that something that you're interested in?
No, I hate, really? I don't like any of that stuff. I don't care. I'm just like, mix it and send it to me when it's done. I like writing music. I don't even really particularly like writing music. I mean, I write music because I do like it, but I like playing music. That's right. That's where I'm at. I like to play music. I don't, the rest of it, like I like to write and I like to record, but I really like to play.
Yeah. I mean, collaboration's also been a big part of your life and your career.
Yeah.
And that's obvious. So with the writing process for you, I'm really interested. Like you mentioned that song Prodigal Daughter, and I mean, that's got some really interesting shifts in time and the melody is so unusual. How does it come together for you? Like, I guess take that song for as an example. Do the lyrics come first? Does the melody come first? How do you come up with those sort of shifts in time and tonality that are in a song like that?
Yeah, gosh, I don't even necessarily think of it as I think of those shifts as being shifts. I think of them as just sort of being a part of the story and a part of the narrative of the song.
Yeah.
But for me, melody definitely comes first. Melody and chords. And sometimes there's another song on the record that's also in that sort of weird guitar tuning, which is a drop C capoed pretty high.
Do you mean just the low E string is dropped to a C or?
Yeah. Okay. And then I'm playing out cool. a C with that low C underneath. And I don't know, it kind of gives that sort of like ringy C vibe. And then when it goes to the pre-chorus, I guess, or the I guess this is the chorus that I know forgiveness won't come easy, that part. Then it's like, I can sort of thumb the low string and make, and then play out a D, and it sort of has, then it kind of sounds like a drop D vibe. I don't know, just like things like that, but.
I could not figure out what you were doing, but that actually makes a lot of sense now that I...
Yeah, like that kind of maybe dictates, and I do, there's so many weird tunings on this record, and that was another problem with like having so much time to write is that I'd like put my guitar in these weird tunings and then record the song. And then over the summer when I was trying to like get it ready to play live, I was like, what the fuck did I do? Like, what tuning is this in? Like, yeah. I literally had like no idea what a couple of the songs, what I was doing. And I was like, how was I getting that ringy thing? Like, what note was
that? That's hard shit to figure out once you've like...
It makes so much sense when you're writing a song because you're like in it and then you're writing it and you're like, all right, this is how it goes. And then you go record it and you play it and you're like, no, I'm done with my parts. But then I kind of had no idea how the rest of it went. So I sort of had to relearn a lot of stuff. But that song, that kind of came, I think that the melody and the harmony come first to me. Like and then I work on the lyrics as, you know, kind of usually have placeholder lyrics and an idea for how I want the song to be, but then that can kind of get edited as it goes on.
So do you kind of like hum your way through it or do you just come up with like a bunch of nonsense lyrics?
Like placeholder lyrics. Yeah. Just like nonsensey.
And does any of that ever find its way into the finished song or do you completely ditch all that?
No, sometimes it does. I think with Prodigal Daughter, I mean, I remember starting writing that song. I remember very vividly where I was. I was in my apartment in Gowanus, Brooklyn, like probably in 2011 or something, or 10, and playing and just like, oh, now Rosie. Like, I remember I wrote another verse that was like something about like Jimmy, or it was like going to be like multiple characters throughout the song. Yeah. But that the Rosie character did remain in the song. And then it kind of, I sort of reframed it as being built around that character.
Okay. And then, so what makes you hang on to a song like that for so long?
I really liked that song, but I hadn't finished it. And I remember I couldn't finish it. And then I took it to Tim and it was his idea to kind of that sort of chorus that, you know, I know forgiveness won't come easy, Murphy, that part. But then it was just sort of like, we had one verse and a chorus and that was kind of it. And then I don't know. I never did anything with it probably because I had other songs that I was working on or like, there's just always been a lot of stuff going on for me. Like, I haven't really had this much time to sort of like go back and dig through all this old stuff. But when I was going back through and that song kind of popped into my mind, it just like, it felt like it rang true in this moment that we're in and sort of with the concept for the rest of the record, it just felt like a strong part of what this record was forming around it of like, just, you know, the sort of the idea that we're living in this crazy time and there would be this, you know, as I'm sure you've read in the press release, like this 20-year period of adulthood from 9/11 to the pandemic and just sort of all the feelings that are going around that and the feelings of home and, you know, traveling and returning and being separated from your family and just all those things. It felt like I wanted to finish it because I wanted that song on this record.
This show is brought to you by the good folks at iZotope, who make incredible plug-in software for any music or dialogue recording situation. Among other things, they make a very unique suite of software called RX, which you can use to surgically repair almost any kind of issue in a recording. Whether it's removing electrical hum, unwanted noise, vocal plosives, or almost anything you can throw at it. I use iZotope RX on every mix in one way or another, and I love that I can get in there on guitar tracks that I'm doing and running through my crazy old tube amps and get rid of the hum and noise without affecting the actual tone of the guitar. You can buy their plugins outright or get a subscription to keep up to date on all their latest versions. Right now, they're offering listeners a 10% discount on any of their plugins when you use the code SOULPOD10 at checkout. So head on over to iZotope.com/soulpod, and you'll see the links right there to get the discount or an extended 30-day trial of their subscription service of Music Production Suite Pro. We're also brought to you this season by Black Mountain Picks. These are unique spring-loaded thumb picks that are super comfortable and adaptable. I've been using them for a couple years now, and I absolutely love them. They come in medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz-tipped, left-handed, and with regular or extra-tight spring tension. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. Thanks to our other sponsor, Union Tube and Transistor. They're known for guitar effects pedals with a focus on quality and simplicity. They build durable, repairable products that sound amazing, both on stage and in the studio. I use their Sonebender fuzz pedal, the Moore pedal, and the Swindle overdrive pedal all the time in sessions and live on stage. You can find them at uniontone.com. And thanks to Spectra 1964. For over 50 years, Spectra 1964 has established a reputation of creating some of the most innovative recording equipment on the market today. From the legendary V610, C610, and 611 complimeter units to the new 500 series Lunchbox mic pres and EQs, Spectra 1964 continues the legacy of providing incredible recording products for the home or professional studio. Check them out at spectra1964.com. And finally, the Hen House Hang. It's a four-day immersive recording experience right here with me at the Hen House Studio in East Nashville on September 19 to 22, 2022. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll put you up in a groovy hotel, feed you some glorious food, show you the ropes of recording roots and Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up. You can get all the info on that at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Hen House Hang. All right then, let's get back to the show. And then what about the production, I guess, with that song? Like, what I hear, like, there's, it sounds to me like there's two rhythm guitars kind of
That's me. I'm playing both those guitars. I did one with the, you know, how I wrote it in drop C, capo it on the ninth fret. And then I did, no, maybe seventh fret. I can't remember what fret it is, but it's an, I don't even remember what key the song is in. And then I did one out of G that I'm playing with a pick. So one's finger pick, one finger style, and then one's like sort of like a flat picky or drop, you know, whatever.
Okay, cool.
And then that's just bass and drums. And then Tim O'Brien plays mandola.
And so when you do something like that has a couple of guitar parts, is that something that you are thinking of like right off the bat, or does that come into focus? Are you kind of, you know, just like fucking around and finding cool stuff to add and that comes together? Or was that like early on, you were like, this is going to have two kind of different tonality guitar parts?
I guess I don't really think like that. Like I said, I'm not like a, it's just not how my like musical brain works, I guess. Like when I write a song, I don't want anything to be essential except for the song itself. So right. It's natural to add a second guitar part, especially if you're in the studio, because it's like, what else are you going to do? You're just going to keep on putting guitar parts down until there's something else to do. But I do feel strongly that songs, at least songs that I write, can just be whatever, like can exist without, almost without anything. And I think that when I got to do that song with Allie at Newport, it's just me playing just the fingerstyle part, you know, capoed high, and the two of us singing. And I feel like that's kind of all it needs. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't even need, I don't think it needs the other part necessarily,
right.
but it's the kind of song that hopefully people will want to play. And it's an easy guitar song. And it would probably sound great with 10 guitars around a campfire. You know what I mean? It's like sort of, but I think as a writer and as, you know, somebody who makes records, you don't, I don't want the production to ever be so extreme that, that the song, that you lose sight of the song itself. And the song needs to be able to stand alone without, without anything, without drums, without bass, without anything except for, you know, the music and the chords.
What about a song like Phoenix? Like, that's another one to me that jumps out as having just such an unusual melody. And also, I can't really tell with that, but it sounds like you're in some sort of weird tuning.
I am. I'm in drop D. The two E's are both tuned down to D.
Oh, and I use that tuning all the time.
Yeah, that's a great tuning. And capoed 5 for that. So that's like kind of has that real nice ringy. Oh, and you know what? I think that actually also the B string is tuned down to an A. No, it's not.
Oh, then that's dadgad.
No, it's not dadgad. It's just the two. It's just the top two. Yeah. It's just the bottom and the top. Yeah.
The E's down to D's.
Yep. E's down to D's. Yeah. And then it kind of.
I use that all the time. I love that tuning.
It's a great tuning. It's so ringy. And then I like a lot of the sort of high, like just utilizing the lowest two strings with the, like the slide down of the chorus.
So in that song, were you in that tuning messing around and that's how the song came together? Like the melody is just so unusual.
Kind of. Yeah. I that song actually started with me looking through some old notes and I saw like I'd written down just one phrase. I wrote down "Time's not the villain." And I don't know, I just started like that. That was really a jumping off point for where I was at with the concept for the record or just in general where I was at in my life of being like, I have not written anything. I don't know what am I doing? What's happening with this pandemic? We're still in it. Like I don't have any shows. That's all like my whole life is playing music. And I just sort of started to think about that as a concept. And that, then it kind of just became this mantra of like, fever's got me shaken. I know when I came up with that chorus, I just remember being so happy. Like I was so really? Euphoric after I wrote that song, like literally euphoria that lasted for like weeks because it felt like this catharsis of,
it was like a breakthrough.
It was a breakthrough. That song was like a complete breakthrough for me. And I
feel it was
like,
a phoenix.
Yeah, exactly. And it's then that was what it was about. It was about like rising up out of it and like coming out of the fever and being like, I'm ready to move forward now. And And there's something about that tuning too, that I kind of think just has that sort of like ringy, positive, but like still, I don't know, like nebulous because it's not super 30. I don't know. It's just, I'm really proud of that song.
And then like B61, that's the one, that's the, yeah, the bus number, right?
The one of the bus numbers. It's actually two bus one numbers on the record.
Right.
Lucky Star is also a bus.
Oh, okay. So that tune is sort of based around keyboard. So are you like, do you play piano?
Yeah.
I've never seen you do that. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I wrote that song on piano. I wrote a couple of the songs on this record on piano. And I do also play a lot of piano. I'm playing piano on Galahad and playing piano on.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Town of Mercy. And there's a bunch of stuff I play piano on the record, but I don't play piano live because I don't have travel with piano. But I wrote B61. Actually, I started writing that a month into the pandemic, 41 days into the pandemic, actually, when I got to that last verse of, you know, for 41 days and as many nights. But then kind of just reworked it and worked on the bridge a little more when I got down here. And yeah, that started as piano. And there's more, I feel like that's maybe why, I'm not sure if I would have come up with that bridge on the guitar necessarily. And like the slide back into the original key.
Yeah. So when you play that live, like going forward, will you just play that on guitar?
Yeah, we have played it live. Okay. We played it on guitar and it's actually really cool. It's like more spare and the band that I'm touring with behind this record is Issa Burke on electric guitar, Ethan Yojevitz on bass, and my friend Robert McMillan on drums. And it's been a cool thing where it starts with just bass and then I come in. I also have some acoustic versions of all this stuff that you can hear that I recorded as sort of like a companion piece to the record. And there's a really cool just guitar version of B61 that I like a lot.
Oh, nice. I like that song a lot. It's cool.
Thanks.
So you have been doing some shows.
I mean, I did some shows in the fall. I did shows up through the end of October, kind of a variety of rescheduled shows and mishmash of stuff, some with the new Age of Apathy band and then some sort of with string quartet that I was supposed to do in March of 2020. And we're hoping we were supposed to be in Europe for 3 weeks this month and next, but that's, you know, obviously not in the cards at the moment. But it looks like all the U.S. stuff is going to be good to go. It doesn't start till the end of February, so I think we'll be in good shape by then.
The obvious differences aside from making your other records, I'd love to hear a little bit about how the process was different for you from so working with Tucker. I guess he did your first solo record and your second solo record.
Exactly.
And he's a great guy and
the best.
And has a, yeah, it's got a great vibe. Was he like, how did you hook up with him in the first place?
I hooked up with Tucker. I had been a Tucker Martine super fan since 2003.
So which stuff of his were you super into?
I'll tell you, I met Sarah Siskind in 2003 at the Four Corners Folk Festival. And she and I were both singing with the Wayfaring Strangers, or maybe it was 2004. I think it was 2003, but I could look it up. So this kind of jazz bluegrass band out of Boston that was sort of like a large 9-piece touring outfit. And I was very young. I was probably 20 years old. And she gave me her CD. This was like back in the day. And I was absolutely blown away by it. I was like, what is this? Like, what is this music? There's Bill Frisell. There's all this weird shit. And it was produced by Tucker Martine. That was the first time I had ever heard of him. It's called Covered. It's her first solo record, I think, from when she was quite young. And it blew me away. And I was sort of like said to myself then and there, like, I need to make a solo album and it needs to be produced by Tucker Martine. And I hadn't made any records at this point. Like, you know, I'd made recorded a little bit with Wayfaring Strangers, and Crooked Still had maybe just recorded our first album.
Okay.
But I sort of set this goal for myself that I wanted to make a record with Tucker. And fast forward, you know, we had crossed paths, and fast forward over the next 8-9 years. Finally, I met him after he did an Abby Washburn record. I was on tour with Crooked Still and our friend Jamie Dick, who I'm sure you know through.
I do very well. Yeah,
Allie. He was on tour with Crooked Still, like tour managing or driving us around. It was awesome. It was a great vibe. And Jamie invited Tucker to our show at the Aladdin, and we met and we just hit it off. And I was like, I really want to make a solo record. I haven't done it yet. At this point, I was like in talks with some labels to do a solo thing. And I was like, would you want to work with me? And he's like, yeah. And then that's basically how it happened. I sent him some song ideas and we got together and we made Fossils, and then we made Magic Hour, and we're super close. And like, I'm sure we'll work together again, cause we have a great deep friendship. And, he was at my show, one of my shows I did over the summer, and then again at Newport. He's just the greatest. He's the greatest guy.
So when you worked with him, like say on Fossils, like was that intimidating at all because you held him in such high regard, and then suddenly you're in the studio with him, or was it very relaxed?
He's just like not an intimidating person.
No, I know.
So it's a no. Maybe it was like for the first day because I didn't know him yet, but he's such an immediate, like I feel like he's a family member. Like he's just such a such a good, kind, loving human who just like has such incredible ears, listens so hard, cares so much about the music that he's making and the records that he's producing. Like almost to a point where you're just like, wow, like you really, he's like, yeah, when I was out for my walk at midnight last night, listening to all the stuff we did today. And I'm like, dude, he's just,
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He's really special.
Does he play drums on that stuff, or does he bring
a drummer? No, he brings a drummer. Okay. So he actually introduced me On Fossils, my friend Robin McMillan played, who's going to be in my touring band for this record. And then Tucker introduced me to Steve Nister, who is a great drummer who played, you know, kind of with, he played in the Brian Blade folk band, Mama Rosa. He was a Portland based guy. And Steve ended up playing on In the Magic Hour and then also touring with me for that whole record cycle. And we became a great friend and colleague.
And so what were some of the highlights for you of the, of those two records, like working, I don't know if you did them at Flora or
we did.
You did them elsewhere. You did? Okay.
Yeah.
At the old Flora, I guess.
The old Flora. Not like Flora 2.0, I think, because there was also the old Flora. They were great. I loved just sort of doing records like that where I would go somewhere and I would rent to like a little Airbnb. And for Fossils, it was just one chunk of time. I was there for 2 weeks and made Fossils. Magic Hour was a little bit different. Like I went out first for, I think, 12 days or 14 days. And then I went back out for another 14 days, like in a different month. And both times, like rented an Airbnb by myself, like lived in Portland. Basically, we had this great schedule where we would work, you know, nine to six and go home and then come back the next day kind of refreshed. It was just a really cool work schedule. It kind of put me in that mindset of like having a work schedule. I think Tucker was probably the first person that I worked with who was on that schedule. I think maybe it kind of coincided with like a time in life where when you're in your 20s, you like sleep till noon and you want to record all day. You just like eat chips
and all night
and it doesn't matter. But then like when I made Fossils right before I turned 30 and I was like, oh, like you can get up and go for a run and go to the studio and be done and have dinner and go to bed.
Amazing.
kind of boring, but it was a kind of a wake up call of like how to be sustainable in your recording.
Right.
Vibe.
Yeah. And I mean, those records they're different sounding from the new one. I don't know in your mind, what makes them different. For me, they seem like the atmospheric stuff is more of a part of it. There's sort of textures that drop in and out, sort of hallmarks of what Tucker does so well,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
Was that something that you were also involved in, or did you kind of let him and the musicians shape that?
I noticed
like with vocals, like there's a lot of doubled vocals and things like that on those records that I don't hear as much on the new record.
It's interesting to like compare them. I think there are definitely, there's definitely more of the Tucker stamp of like Avind Kang's, you know, that sort of like violin sound, I feel like is so Tucker. And even like the way the drums are and the way the bass is. But I think that more than anything, like these songs, I think because they were written in such a more condensed period, like I feel like there's just, I'm like saying more on this record than I did on those previous records. Maybe because the time is different and because the songs were just sort of written in like a fury in a way that they weren't on previous records, especially Fossils, where I was sort of, when you make your first record, you're kind of drawing from this well of material that you've had for, you know, kicking around for your whole life as a songwriter, and you pick whatever you want from that and you kind of put it together as a record. But I do also think that how we've made records and how we think about records has changed in the last 10 years. And even since I made Magic Hour in the fall of
2016?
No, because it came out. I know. I feel like it came out in January of 2016.
It's got the date on it is 2016. So yeah, you must have made it in 2015.
I think I made it in 2014.
Oh, okay.
I think I recorded it at the end of 2014 and then it came out a year later. Like the way that, that is how it happened. So I think how we think about records is just different now or at least how I think about records is different now.
I wanted to ask you about that song Beekeeper. What record is that on?
Fossils.
So that one, is that a crazy tuning as well?
That's just drop D, capo 3.
It is?
Yeah.
That's such a cool, like the whole vibe of it is cool. Is the finger picking stuff like that? Like, do you use your fingers? What's going on?
Yeah, I use my thumb. I use my thumbnail and I use mostly these two fingers, like my claw, but then these three. And then sometimes I throw in these two.
Okay. So guitar wise, do you have distinct influences in your mind? Like people that you figured out how to play from, or were you always sort of like figuring out how to accompany yourself to get your songs across?
I guess, I mean, I had a guitar teacher when I was in high school who taught me, basic guitar stuff. But I, other than that, I would say I'm pretty self-taught and pretty mediocre. But it's I like listening to people like Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, like even that sort of really finger style guitar. I feel like those are the songs that I learned how to play first.
Do you remember specific songs?
Like Sweet Sir Galahad, like Don't Think Twice, It's All Right.
That's actually a pretty tricky little number to play.
Yeah. But I feel like those are kind of some of the first songs that I learned how to play. And then I think I've spent a lot more time playing the guitar and practicing the guitar and getting better at guitar over the years, especially in the last couple of years. I think when I'm With Her started, I felt like I really had to up my game and try to at least come up to where they are halfway. They're like serious instrumental virtuosos and I'm just like playing rhythm guitar. But I think that definitely made me a more confident guitar player, I think, which then makes you a better guitar player.
You guys for I'm With Her came together at some festival or something, right? Or were we
were old friends. I mean, we've all been friends for many years and sang on each other's records and you know, hung out at festivals, et cetera. But we got together, the trio kind of formed at Telluride in 2014.
How did that actually happen? Did somebody say, hey, do you guys want to get on stage together or did you plan it?
Well, we were on a workshop together and kind of like that. We were the only three who could like get together beforehand to work something up. So that happened. And then later that day, Chris Thiele texted me and was like, oh, do you want to open for us at the Sheraton Opera House tonight? And I was like, yeah, we'll be there. And we went there and we rehearsed in the bathroom and put together like a 6 or 7 song set, like literally. And it was like electric.
Of what material?
Random stuff. Like we did like Blue Moon of Kentucky. We did some original stuff. We did some other more like bluegrassy stuff. But it was it was electric. And then we got together later that fall. And now this is all the timing is making sense now because we got together and then we, right after I had been working on my record and we put together, so I went to Portland, recorded in the Magic Hour, part of it, flew back, worked on a set because I'm With Her to Send decided in the fall that we were going to go do a European tour, just like we kind of made up our band and we're like, all right, we're going to be a band. And we had to put together a set of material. So we put together a set of material from our catalogs, but also a bunch of covers. And then that was that. Just kind of took off from there. It was like the ship that couldn't stop moving.
What were those records like to make? Like, how were they different from what you were doing with the solo stuff?
I'm With Her record? Yeah. With Her record? It was just one record, I mean, plus a single. That record was a completely different experience, once again, from anything we've been talking about, in that it was literally just us in a room, the same room as Ethan Johns and Dom Monks, the engineer, at Real World Studios in the middle of January for 3 weeks, playing music like, you know, 2 feet from each other in a triangle with no headphones. Everything was entirely live. They were in the same room as us on a couch, like, you know, 50, not even 50, like 20 feet away. And it was like, this is it. It's like a real, very Ethan Johns, like no reverb. Like I love how that record sounds, but remembering
Are there no overdubs on that record?
Oh, there's like one overdub where like, I think I like overdubbed a piano thing on Overland, like a Glockenspiel thing.
How inspiring was being in a place like Real World?
Oh, it was really inspiring, but it was also like very.
I've never seen it, but I've seen pictures and it's kind of bananas, right?
Well, we were in the small room, which is like, it's okay. We were there in the month of January. Like and we were like sequestered there, you know, like we didn't have a car. We didn't have like, we were literally just like, and we were living there and eating all of our meals there.
I don't even know where it is. Like it's out in the countryside somewhere.
It's out in the countryside. Yeah. It's outside of a little town called Box, which is outside of Bath, like an hour from Bath.
Okay.
And it's like literally in the middle of nowhere. And
how did that end up happening?
I don't even know. He was like on our short list and we asked him if he would produce the record and he said yes. But you know, this is where he works. So we all flew over there and that was that.
Oh, so he's sort of mobbed up with Real World. I didn't realize.
Yeah, he lives really close to there. So it's easy for him because he can just like drive over and then drive back. Yeah.
Okay. All right, cool. And so what was the thing with, what was the vibe with him like? He was sort of involved in sonically putting you guys together, but also like, was he actively contributing to the arrangements and the songs or not so much?
In some ways. I mean, it's like his stamp is very much, like, I feel like he has this magic kind of without, makes it seem like you feel like he's not doing that much, but he actually is doing a lot. Like he creates this vibe, creates this environment. And yeah, like just kind of is able to coax this magic thing out of musicians in a way that's, I don't know. It's really weird. I just finished watching Get Back finally last night. Have you watched it?
I did. Yeah.
But I can't stop thinking about it. I watched the first two before Christmas. And then for some reason, like we tried to get my family to catch up so we could watch episode three together, but nobody did. And so we finally finished it last night. We watched episode three last night. And I'm just like, Glyn Johns in that movie, like that's just thinking, I don't know, everybody's role in that 8 hours of footage. Oh God, it's real. I can't stop thinking about it. It's like, all I want to do is I want to watch it again.
I know it's so interesting and kind of heartbreaking in a way. And so inspiring in a way and eye-opening too, just like seeing, for me, it was like seeing how much fucking around happened.
And that was the part that felt the most relatable to me. Like the part it really felt like, as Critter, my friend Chris Eldridge, he was like, yeah, you know, you see this thing, it's like stars are just like us. He was like, Beatles are just like us. the amount of fucking around is hilarious. But also like my favorite, I think the moment for me that like makes me just want to cry is like the whole movie. I kept on saying to my husband, like, what is John, like John is doing nothing. Like, what is the point of John Lennon right now? Like he's amazing when he finally does open his mouth and like gets there. But then at the end of the movie, when they're on the rooftop and he's singing, and it literally burst into tears. Cause I'm gonna cry thinking about it. Like, it was like that moment where you're like, this is like why we all do this, is because if everything sucks and it's so hard to like break through to get to the next point, all that matters is that you're just on stage or doing or playing live with your friends, with your people. And it's like, like I finished that last night and I've just been like, felt so full of hope today for like everything. Yeah. Like it
makes me wonder if they edited out like a lot of his really productive behavior and just showed him like his childish screwing around behavior. Cause that's basically, you're right. Like that's what he's doing the entire movie, is just like doing a polka version of Mean Mr. Mustard, like the weirdest shit.
He but I think seems it's because never, he was high.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Like, I never see him doing any drugs, so I don't really have a grip on how high he was.
I think that, yeah. I don't know either. I read on some like website that Disney didn't want them to talk about drugs, but like that they were like really deep into heroin at the time. I don't know. This is like all just like the,
because he's pretty coherent.
No, he is pretty coherent, but it's, I'm so glad that like, I just love this, having this sort of shared experience of watching that film and then talking about it with other musicians, because it feels like,
me too.
It feels like this, I don't know, like you were given this like a secret window into.
Oh, it's so
world.
Secret. And it's, I know. Yeah. It's so great. It's so unusual. And like, I've never seen anything like it. That's for sure.
I just said to my dad,
it's good to see seeing those guys like that go through something like that too, where you're like, oh, they are human beings. That's kind of interesting.
Oh, I'm so glad that you watched it too. And it's been so nice talking with you. I hope that
you too. Thank you so much. I'm really excited about the new record. I think it's phenomenal. And thanks for talking to me about it today. And hope to see you down in Nashville, or
yes,
up in Nashville, I guess, for you.
Up and over. I know. It's funny. I was like, wait, where am I?
Do you have a show coming up here?
I think I do, but I can't remember when it is. Sometime in the spring.
All right. Awesome.
But we'll reach out. Yeah. And thanks again for recording, okay, Allie, and for all you do. And
you're welcome.
I appreciate it. And great to chat with you soon.
Thanks. You too.
Take care. Okay. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye. All right. That was my conversation with Aoife O'Donovan. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did having it. And we'll see you in a couple weeks for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. We'll see you then. Yeah. Music Makers and Soul Shakers is produced at the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee by Steve Dawson. Please remember to subscribe to the show and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist, at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors this season, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, Isotope, and Spectra 1964. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.